34. To Apollon Nikolaevich Maikov. Geneva, August the 16th, 28th, 1867. So long have I kept silence and not answered your welcome letter, my dear and unforgettable friend Apollon Nikolaevich. I call you unforgettable friend, and feel deep in my heart that that description is just. We are both such old and accustomed friends that life, which sometimes parted us and even separated us, not only has not succeeded in really separating us, but has actually drawn us closer together. You write that you feel my absence to a certain extent. Much more do I feel yours. Quite apart from the fact that every day shows me more clearly the likeness and sympathy between our thoughts and feelings, I beg you to observe as well that I, since I lost you, have come over into a strange land, where not only are there no Russian faces, Russian books, Russian thoughts and concerns, but no friendly faces of any sort. I truly cannot understand how any Russian living abroad, if he be a man of heart and intelligence, can fail to notice this and be made miserable by it. Perhaps all these faces are friendly to one another. I can only say that I feel they're not friendly to us. It really is so. How can people endure this living abroad? By God, without home, life is torture. I can understand going abroad for 6 months or even a year, but to travel, as I do, without knowing or even guessing when one will get home again, is very bad and grievous. The mere thought of it is hard to bear. I need Russia for my work, for my life. I speak of no life but that. I am like a fish out of water. I lose all my energies, all my faculties. You know in what circumstances I left home, and for what reason. There are two principal reasons. In the first place, I had to save my health and even my life. The attacks were recurring every 8 days, and it was unbearable to feel and recognize the destruction of my nerves and brain. I really was beginning to lose my senses, that is a fact. I felt it. The ruin of my nerves often drove me to the very edge of things. The second reason is that my creditors would wait no longer, and on the day of my departure several summonses were out against me. He pursues the topic of his debts. The burden was unbearable. I departed with death in my heart. I had no faith in foreign lands, rather I believed they might have had a bad moral effect upon me. I was wholly isolated, without resources, and with a young creature by my side who was naively delighted at sharing my wandering life, but I saw that that naive delight arose partly from inexperience and youthful ardour, and this depressed and tormented me. I was afraid that Anna Grigorievna would find life with me a tedious thing, for up to the present we have been literally alone. Of myself I could hope little. My nature is morbid, and I anticipated that she would have much to bear from me. N.B. Anna Grigorievna indeed proved herself to be of a nature much stronger and deeper than I had expected. In many ways she has been my guardian angel. At the same time, there is much that is childish and immature in her, and very beautiful, and most necessary and natural it is, only I can hardly respond to it. All this I saw vaguely before our departure, and although, as I said, Anna Grigorievna is finer and stronger than I had guessed, I am not even now free from all uneasiness. Finally, our insufficient means caused me much anxiety. We had only a very little money, and owed Katkov an advance of 3,000 rubles. To be sure, I intended to begin work immediately after our departure. But what actually came to pass? Up to the present I have accomplished nothing, or almost nothing, and want now to set seriously to work at last. I must confess that I don't feel sure I've really accomplished nothing, for I have lived through so much, and framed so much in my mind. Still, in black and white, I have set down very little as yet, and only what stands written in black and white is valid and money-making. We left tedious Berlin as soon as we could. I could only stop one day there, for the tiresome Germans made me nervous and irascible, and I had to take refuge in the Russian baths, and went to Dresden. In Dresden we took lodgings and installed ourselves for a time. The effect was very singular. Instantly this question presented itself to me. Why am I in Dresden, just Dresden, and not in any other town? And why on earth had I to leave one place and go to another? The answer was most clear: my health, the debts, etc. But worse is the clear perception that now I don't in the least care where I may have to dwell. In Dresden or another town, everywhere in foreign lands, I feel like a slice cut from the loaf. I had meant to set to work the very first day, but I felt that I could not possibly work there, that all my impressions were topsy-turvy. What did I do? I vegetated. I read, wrote a few lines now and then, nearly died of homesickness, and later of heat. The days went monotonously by. I can't possibly tell you all my thoughts. I collected many impressions. I read Russian newspapers and solaced myself thus. I felt eventually that so many new ideas had been garnered up that I could write a long article on Russia's relations to Western Europe and on the upper classes of Russian society. I should indeed have had plenty to say. The Germans got on my nerves, and our Russian way of living, the life of the upper classes, the faith in Europe and civilization in which those upper classes are steeped, all that got on my nerves also. The incident in Paris upset me frightfully. Impressive, weren't they? The Paris lawyers who cried, "Vive la Pologne!" Phew, how nauseous, how stupid, how insipid. I felt more than ever confirmed in my view that it is rather advantageous for us that Europe does not know us in the least and has such a disgusting idea of us. And then the details of the proceedings against Berezovsky. How ugly, how empty. I can't imagine how they can ever recover from such twaddle and get on to the next point. Russia, seen from here, looks to a Russian more plastic. On the one hand is the rare fact that our people have shown such unexpected independence and maturity in the initiation of reforms, as, for example, the judicial ones. On the other, there is that news of the flogging of a merchant of the First Guild in the Orenburg government by the chief of police. One thing is clear, that the Russian people, thanks to its benefactor and his reforms, is at last in such a situation that it must of necessity accustom itself to affairs and self-criticism. And that's the principal thing. By God, our age, in regard to reforms and changes, is almost as important as that of Peter the Great. How goes it with the railways? We must get down as quickly as possible to the south. This is tremendously important. Before then, we must have equitable tribunals everywhere. How great will be the transformation? I, over here, keep thinking of all these things, and my heart beats fast. I see hardly anyone here. It is quite impossible, though, not to come across somebody or other. In Germany, I met a Russian who always lives abroad. He goes to Russia for about 3 weeks each year, and then returns to Germany, where he has a wife and family. They have all become German through and through. Among other things, I asked him, "Why actually did you leave home?" He answered me hotly and curtly, "Because here is civilization, and with us is barbarism." This gentleman belongs to the young progressives, but seems to keep himself aloof from them all to some extent. What snarling, peevish curs all these absentees do become. At last, Anna Grigorievna and I could no longer bear our homesickness in Dresden. We decided to spend the winter somewhere in Switzerland or Italy. But we had no money at all. What we had brought with us was all spent. I wrote to Katkov, described my situation, and begged him for a further advance of 500 rubles. And what do you think? He sent me the money. What an excellent fellow he is. So we came to Switzerland. Now I am going to confess to you my baseness and my shame. My dear Apollon Nikolaevich, I feel that I may regard you as my judge. You have heart and feeling, as I have always, and of late freshly, been convinced, and therefore I have ever prized your judgment highly. I don't suffer in confessing my sins to you. What I write to you today is meant for you alone. Deliver me not to the judgment of the mob. When I was travelling in the neighbourhood of Baden-Baden, I decided to turn aside and visit the place. I was tortured by a seductive thought. 10 louis d'or to risk, and perhaps 2,000 francs to win. Such a sum would suffice me for 4 months, even with the expenses that I have in Petersburg. The vile part of it is that in earlier years I had occasionally won. But the worst is that I have an evil and exaggeratedly passionate nature. In all things I go to the uttermost extreme. My life long I have never been acquainted with moderation. The devil played his games with me at the beginning. In 3 days I won, unusually easily, 4,000 francs. Now I'll show you how I work matters out. On the one hand, this easy gain, from 100 francs I had in 3 days made 4,000. On the other, my debts, my summonses, my heartfelt anxiety, and the impossibility of getting back to Russia. In the third place, and this is the principal point, the play itself. If you only knew how it draws one on. No, I swear to you, it was not the love of winning alone, though I actually needed the money for the money's sake. Anna Grigorievna implored me to be contented with the 4,000 francs and depart at once. But that easy and probable possibility of bettering my situation at one blow. And the many examples. Apart from my own gains, I saw every day how the other gamblers won from 20,000 to 30,000 francs. One never sees anyone lose. Why should those others do better than I? I need the money more than they do. I risked again and lost. I lost not only what I had won, but also my own money down to the last farthing. I got feverishly excited and lost all the time. Then I began to pawn my garments. Anna Grigorievna pawned her last, her very last possession. That angel. How she consoled me, how she suffered in that cursed Baden, in our 2 tiny rooms above the blacksmith's forge, the only place we could afford. At last I had had enough. Everything was gone. How base are these Germans! They are all usurers, rascals and cheats. When our landlady saw that we could not leave, having no money, she raised our prices. At last we had to save ourselves somehow and flee from Baden. I wrote again to Katkov and begged him for 500 rubles. I wrote nothing of the circumstances, but as the letter came from Baden, he probably guessed the state of affairs. And he sent me the money. He did, really. So now I have had altogether from the Ruski Vyestnik 4,000 rubles in advance. Now to end my Baden adventures, we agonized in that hell for 7 weeks. Directly after my arrival there, I met Goncharov at the railway station. At first, Ivan Alexandrovich was cautious before me. That state councillor, or state councillor that ought to be, was also occupied in gambling. But when he realized that it could not be kept a secret, and as I myself was playing with gross publicity, he soon ceased to pretend to me. He played with feverish excitement, though only for small stakes. He played during the whole fortnight that he spent in Baden, and lost, I think, quite a good deal. But God gave this good fellow health. When I had lost everything, he had, however, seen me with large sums in my hands, he gave me, at my request, 60 francs. Certainly he lectured me terribly at the same time, because I had lost all, and not only half, like him. Goncharov talked incessantly about Turgenev. I kept putting off my visit to him. Still, eventually I had to call. I went about noon, and found him at breakfast. I'll tell you frankly, I never really liked that man. The worst of it is that since 1857 at Wiesbaden, I've owed him $50, which even today I haven't yet paid back. I can't stand the aristocratic and pharisaical sort of way he embraces one and offers his cheek to be kissed. He puts on monstrous airs, but my bitterest complaint against him is his book, Smoke. He told me himself that the leading idea, the point at issue in that book, is this. If Russia were destroyed by an earthquake and vanished from the globe, it would mean no loss to humanity. It would not even be noticed. He declared to me that that was his fundamental view of Russia. I found him in irritable mood. It was on account of the failure of Smoke. I must tell you that at the time the full details of that failure were unknown to me. I had heard by letter of Strachov's article in the OZ, but I didn't know that they had torn him to pieces in all the other papers as well, and that in Moscow, at a club, I believe, people had collected signatures to a protest against Smoke. He told me that himself. Frankly, I never could have imagined that anyone could so naively and clumsily display all the wounds in his vanity as Turgenev did that day. And these people go about boasting that they are atheists. He told me that he was an uncompromising atheist. My God! It is to deism that we owe the Saviour. That is to say, the conception of a man so noble that one cannot grasp it without a sense of awe, a conception of which one cannot doubt that it represents the undying ideal of mankind. And what do we owe to these gentry? Turgenev, Herzen, Yutin, Chernyshevsky. In place of that loftiest divine beauty on which they spit, we behold them in such ugly vanity, such unashamed susceptibility, such ludicrous arrogance, that it is simply impossible to guess what it is that they hope for, and who shall take them as guides. He frightfully abused Russia and the Russians. But I have noticed this. All those liberals and progressives who derive chiefly from Bielinski's school find their pleasure and satisfaction in abusing Russia. The difference is that the adherents of Chernyshevsky merely abuse, and in so many words desire that Russia should disappear from the face of the earth, that first of all. But the others declare, in the same breath, that they love Russia. And yet they hate everything that is native to the soil. They delight in caricaturing it, and were one to oppose them with some fact that they could not explain away or caricature, any fact with which they were obliged to reckon, they would, I believe, be profoundly unhappy, annoyed, even distraught. And I've noticed that Turgenev, and for that matter all who live long abroad, have no conception of the true facts, though they do read the newspapers, and have so utterly lost all affection and understanding for Russia that even those quite ordinary matters which in Russia the very nihilists no longer deny, but only, as it were, caricature after their manner, these fellows cannot so much as grasp. Among other things, he told me that we are bound to crawl in the dust before the Germans, that there is but one universal and irrefutable way, that of civilization, and that all attempts to create an independent Russian culture are but folly and pig-headedness. He said that he was writing a long article against the Russophiles and Slavophiles. I advised him to order a telescope from Paris for his better convenience. "What do you mean?" he asked. "The distance is somewhat great," I replied. "Direct the telescope on Russia, and then you will be able to observe us. Otherwise you can't really see anything at all." He flew into a rage. When I saw him so angry, I said with well-simulated naivete, Really, I should never have supposed that all the articles derogatory to your new novel could have discomposed you to this extent. My God, the thing's not worth getting so angry about. Come, spit upon it all. I'm not in the least discomposed. What are you thinking of? He answered, getting red. I interrupted him and turned the talk to personal and domestic matters. Before going away, I brought forth, as if quite casually and without any particular object, all the hatred that these 3 months have accumulated in me against the Germans. Do you know what swindlers and rogues they are here? Verily, the common people are much more evil and dishonest here than they are with us. And that they are stupider there can be no doubt. You are always talking of civilization. With what has your civilization endowed the Germans, and wherein do they surpass us? He turned pale, it is no exaggeration, and said, In speaking thus you insult me personally. You know quite well that I have definitely settled here, that I consider myself a German and not a Russian, and am proud of it. I answered, Although I have read your smoke and have just talked with you for a whole hour, I could never have imagined that you would say such a thing. Forgive me, therefore, if I have insulted you. Then we took leave of one another very politely, and I promised myself that I would never again cross Turgenev's threshold. The next day, Turgenev came at exactly 10 o'clock in the morning to my abode and left his card with the landlady. But as I had told him the day before that I never saw anyone till noon, and that we usually slept till 11, I naturally took his 10 o'clock call as a hint that he doesn't wish to see any more of me. During the whole 7 weeks, I saw him only once more at the railway station. We looked at one another, but no greeting passed. The animosity with which I speak of Turgenev, and the insults we offered one another, will perhaps strike you unpleasantly. But by God, I can no other. He offended me too deeply with his amazing views. Personally, I really feel little affected, though his uppish manners are quite disagreeable enough in themselves. But I simply can't stand by and listen when a traitor, who, if he choose, could be of service to his country, abuses Russia in the way he does. His tail-wagging to the Germans and his hatred for the Russians I had noticed already 4 years ago. But his present rage and fury against Russia arises solely from the failure of smoke, and from the fact that Russia has dared refuse to hail him as a genius. It is nothing but vanity, and therefore all the more repulsive. Hear now, my friend, what I have in view. Of course it was vile in me to gamble away so much, but I have lost a relatively small sum of my own actual money. Still, it would have lasted us for 2 months, in our present mode of living even for 4. I have already told you that I can't resist winning. If, right at the beginning, I had lost the 10 louis d'or that I chose to stake, I should certainly have played no more and gone away at once. But the gain of 4,000 francs destroyed me. The temptation of winning more, which appeared so easy, and in that way paying all my debts, and being able to provide for myself and mine, Emily Fyodorovna, Pasha, and the others, it was too much for me. I could not resist it. But even this is no excuse, for I was not alone. I had with me a young, warm-hearted, pretty creature who trusted me, whom I should have protected and sheltered, and whom consequently I ought not to have dragged down with myself to destitution by setting my entire, though certainly not very great, possessions upon the turn of a game. My future appears to me very dark. Above all, I cannot, for the reasons I have mentioned, return to Russia, and most heavily am I oppressed by the question, what is to become of those who depend on my help? All these thoughts murder me. You alone, my dear friend, are kind to me. You are my providence. Help me in the future, too. For in all my great and small matters, I shall call upon your aid. You well understand the basis of all my hopes. It is clear that only under one condition can everything be arranged so as to bring forth fruit, namely, that my novel really succeeds. To that I must devote all my powers. Ah, my dear fellow, how grave, how unendurably grave it was for me 3 years ago to yield to the crazy hope that I should be able to pay all those debts, and therefore to sign the many bills of exchange. Whence shall I draw the needful energy and vitality? Experience, indeed, has shown that I can make a success. But what are the conditions? These alone, that every one of my works so succeeds as to awaken the keenest public interest, else all goes crash. And is that really possible? Is there any use in reckoning on it? The letter ends with a request for a loan and a further description of Dostoevsky's desperate situation.